Okay, then verse 116. There is no object, no subject, nor no ultimate nature of things. Okay, so in that meditative equipoise on emptiness, there's no appearance of object, there's no appearance of subject, and there's no appearance of an ultimate nature of things. And there is no ultimate nature of things. Okay? Free of all ethical norms and conceptual elaborations. Okay, so when you're in that meditative state on emptiness, okay, direct perception, not a conceptual understanding of emptiness, not a mental image of emptiness, but actually when you're seeing it directly, then there's no ethical norms in that meditative state, because ethical norms means that you're using words and language and concept and things like that. And there's no conceptual elaborations. Okay, so there's no conceptual minds at that time because you're just perceiving the nature of reality. Okay, so within that meditative equipoise on emptiness, you might say there's no ethical norms. Okay, because also there's no eye, no ears, no toe, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no form, no sound, no smell, no taste. Okay? That doesn't mean that when you come out of the meditative equipoise that those things don't exist. Because when you come out of the meditative equipoise, you're dealing with conventional objects again. All those things exist. They appear truly existent, but you know it's a false appearance. And you know instead that they dependently arise. So they exist because they dependently arise. Yeah? And so that's why it's really important to keep precepts and hold to ethical norms. Because even though things are empty on the conventional level, they function and causes bring results. And results come from causes. Okay, so this is always the tricky point, you know, where people can get really, really confused. You know, because first, there's inherently existent causes and effect, and there's karma, and you can't do that because you're a sinner, and if you did that, you're going to hell. And there's a real belief in inherent existence. And then, like I was saying before, you know, those people, when they get some feeling of emptiness, they flop from the extreme of inherent existence to the extreme of non-existence. And they say, oh, there's no ethical norms, you can do whatever you want. Well, that's not true either. That just creates chaos. That's negating cause and effect. If there's no ethical norms and there's no functioning of karma, yeah, then there's no cause and effect. So why do you plant seeds to try and grow a garden? If there's no cause and effect, why plant seeds? Okay, well, even uneducated people know that you plant seeds and plant, you know, conditions come and they grow into plants. Okay, so same way, it's important that we follow the ethical norms. Yeah, because things are empty, because they conventionally exist, because they dependently arise. Okay? But within the state of emptiness, when the mind's perceiving only that, then there's no ethical norms or conceptual elaborations. Okay, so verse 116 is still talking about that state of meditative equipoise. So if I abide naturally with this uncontrived awareness in the ever-present innate state, I'll become a being of great capacity. Okay, so if I abide naturally, so again, without kind of lots of conceptual effort and, you know, clutching and clinging, in the uncontrived awareness, in other words, in the awareness that's not fabricating inherent existence. Yeah, if you abide, you know, focused on that emptiness in the ever-present innate state, okay, so the innate state that things are empty of inherent existence and you're realizing that, then you'll become a being of great capacity. Okay, a mahasattva. Yeah, somebody who can really cross over to the other side and be free of cyclic existence. Okay, then verse 117 is a dedication. So it says, thus, by practicing the conventional mind of awakening, okay, Okay, so the altruistic intention, aspiring for enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings, and the ultimate mind of awakening, so that's the wisdom realizing emptiness. May I accomplish the two accumulations without obstacles. So through practicing the altruistic intention, we accumulate positive potential or merit. By practicing the wisdom, the ultimate mind of awakening, the wisdom realizing emptiness, we accumulate wisdom. So that's why it says, may I accomplish the two accumulations without obstacles, and realize the perfect fulfillment of the two aims. So that's talking about the resultant state. So the two aims are the aim for self, the purpose of self, and the purpose of other. The purpose of self refers to the Dharmakaya, okay, the omniscient mind of a fully enlightened being. And then the purpose of others refers to the Rupakaya, the form body, all these manifestations that a fully enlightened being manifests in for the benefit of sentient beings. So the Dharmakaya, yeah, the omniscient mind, the ultimate nature of that omniscient mind, they're called the purpose of self because that's, you know, one's own realization. But then we don't stay just in that realization. Yeah, so all the Buddhas manifest out in all these different bodies for the benefit of sentient beings, because that's the whole reason why they practice the path, is they wanted to benefit sentient beings. So when they manifest in these form bodies, that's called the purpose of others, because the form bodies teach and guide sentient beings and show them the path to enlightenment. Okay? So through Buddhist practice, we're working for, you know, our own goal and others' goals, and we're working for the happiness of self and others. And so, you know, we shouldn't, in our ordinary way, we always think of, you know, well, my happiness is here and others' happiness is there. And there's only a certain amount of happiness, so if they have it, I don't have it. And if I work for their goals, then I can't work for my goals. Okay? But that's not how we look at things from a Buddhist perspective. You work for both goals, our own and others, and we work for the happiness of both self and others. Okay? So that's Dharma Rakshita's dedication. Then there's a colophon, okay, that I think is quite beautiful. So I'll read it. And it was written by sounds like Shono Gyalcho Kunshokbang, who's one of the lamas in the lineage. So the colophon says, this text entitled The Weapon Wheel, or The Wheel Weapon Striking at the Vital Point of the Enemy. So the vital point of the enemy is the self-centered mind and the self-grasping ignorance. Okay? This was composed in accordance with the instructions of the sublime teachers, so the lineage of teachers, by the great Dharma Rakshita, a yogi of scriptural knowledge, reasoning, and realizations. So I think that's quite interesting. He was a yogi. He had scriptural knowledge, so he learned the teachings. He had reasoning, so he thought about them. And he had realizations because he meditated. So all three things, the hearing, thinking, meditating. So he composed this in a jungle wherein various terrifying animals of prey roam free, and undertook its practice in the terrifying jungle of our degenerate age. Okay, so a jungle is dark and dangerous, and there's all these animals crawling around. You know, the animals of prey roam free. Yeah, ready to eat you. Okay, so I think they're talking about him living in a jungle and composing this in a jungle, but actually the real jungle is samsara. Yeah? And the real animals of prey is our karma. Yeah? That's our karma. It's going to eat us up at any moment now. Okay? And So he practiced in that terrifying jungle, so within samsara. Yeah, he didn't just go off in his own blissful state of peace. He practiced in samsara, in the terrifying jungle of our degenerate age. So our particular historical time is said to be a degenerate age because there's five degenerations. Okay, so the first one is the generation of time, meaning that there's no lasting peace. There's a lot of warfare and famines. True? Okay, second degeneration is the degeneration of sentient beings. So sentient beings are full of wrong views. They're intolerant. They behave outrageously. True? Oh, no, not me. It's all those other people. Okay, then the third is the degeneration of view. So we're full of all sorts of distorted views. We don't believe in cause and effect, don't believe in rebirth, aren't interested in virtuous actions. So all sorts of wrong views. And we see this all around, don't we? Yeah. The fourth degeneration is the degeneration of afflictions, mental afflictions. So our mental afflictions are very gross. Yeah, our attachment is like, you know, like Mount Everest. Our anger is, you know, like the sun, and everything's huge. Our minds are obsessed and difficult to control. And then the fifth degeneration is the degeneration of lifespan. So there's a lot of accidents. There's a lot of pollution. Yeah, medical science makes it so your lifespan is longer, but maybe your quality of life at the end isn't any better. And then there's all sorts of premature deaths because of the pollution and technology and so forth. Okay, so Dhamma Rakshita was practicing in this degenerate age within samsara. So just like us. Yeah, it wasn't like he started out enlightened and it got better. He started out just like us, and yet he practiced this teaching. Okay, and gained the realizations of it, clearly. And he gave this teaching to Atisha. So Atisha was the great Indian sage who renewed Buddhism in Tibet. He lived from the late 10th to the early 11th century. And he gave it to Atisha, who, in order to transform many sentient beings that are so difficult to tame, undertook this practice throughout all places, regardless whatever direction it lay, be it a cardinal or an intermediate direction. So Atisha did this thought training practice everywhere. He didn't just say, I'm doing it on my kit cushion, and there I feel nice and harmonious and I'm forgiving and tolerant. And then when I get up from my kit cushion, that idiot over there, gotta get him. Okay, so he didn't do that. He practiced it everywhere and at all times. And then Atisha uttered the following lines to exclaim his attainment of realizations. And Atisha was born into the royal family of Bengal. So he was very rich. He had a very privileged life. And then he left it all to become a yogi and go roam in the jungle. And then after that, he, went to Nalanda, and he was studying at Nalanda for many years. And after that, they invited him to Tibet, and he went to Tibet. So these are what the words that Atisha uttered. So he said, when I renounced my kingdom and practiced austerity, I accumulated merit and met with my supreme teacher. He revealed to me the sublime Dharma nectar and initiated me into it. Having mastered the antidotes today, I commit the words to my heart. Okay, so he had to leave his kingdom, practice austerities. Yeah, so it means leaving all your attachment and dedicating your mind to the Dharma. Okay, so that's renunciation. So he accumulated merit and then met with his supreme teacher, who was Dharma Rakshita. Actually, Atisha had 147, is it, teachers? Yeah. And one of the best ones, the ones he really cherished, was Lama Serlingpa, who taught him the bodhicitta. But he always appreciated his teachers very much, and they tell this story about Atisha. I wonder if it's true. But, you know, before he ever even said the name of any of his 147 teachers, he would go wash his mouth out, you know, and then put his palms together and then say the name. I mean, he had just this incredible amount of respect and gratitude towards his teachers. So having met the, you know, his teacher who revealed these teachings into him, then he mastered the antidote, so he practiced these teachings. And he committed the words to his heart, so he really integrated them with his very being. So he always appreciated his teachers, because it was his teachers who set him free, his teachers who gave him sovereignty over his own mind. So right now, you know, we're just like buffered around constantly by our afflictions, aren't we? You know, some thought comes in the mind, oh yeah, I'm going to do that. And another thought comes in the mind, oh yeah, I'm going to do that. And another thought comes in, oh, I want this. And another thought comes in, oh, I can't. You know, it's like we have no discriminating wisdom. Every thought that comes in our mind, we believe it, you know, and we follow it. So we have no sovereignty, you know, over our own minds. We're just buffeted around by our mental afflictions all the time. Okay, and we're chock-a-block full of wrong conceptions, you know, just so full of them. It's amazing. So when people say to you, you're full of it, you should say, you're right. I am. I'm full of wrong views. I'm full of mental afflictions. You're absolutely right. That would stop the argument right there, wouldn't it? You know, because they're right, aren't they? Who are we to say, no, I don't have any mental affliction? Well, my mind's, you're right. I'm completely filled with the wrong views. I'm full of it. Okay. So then Atisha continued to say, by casting wide my intelligence free of prejudice. So this is how he practiced, by using his intelligence in a very unbiased mind. So he didn't have this mind that was just like spaced out saying, I believe, you know, the Buddha said it, I believe, you know. Yeah, Buddha said you, he never said you believe things because he said it. He said you think about things and you understand them yourself. So he's saying, you know, he used his intelligence free of prejudice, because he wasn't, you know, trying to defend a view or an institution or anything like that. So casting wide my intelligence free of prejudice to a detailed study of diverse doctrinal systems. Although I have witnessed immeasurable wonders, I found this teaching most helpful to our degenerate age. Okay, so here's somebody who studied widely with all these great masters, you know, and he's witnessed incredible, immeasurable wonders. So, you know, he's seen great yogis do incredible feats. But he said, says very humbly, I've found this teaching most helpful to our degenerate age. So I think he's trying to tell us something. Interesting here, I was reading what Geshe Nawandarge, you know, when he taught this, because that's who I received this teaching first from. He said in response to this, he said, it's not a good sign if we want highest class tantra initiation, but ignore the thought training teachings and the three principal aspects of the path. So he said, it's a degenerate age when we want high teachings and we ignore the thought training. Yeah? That was from Geshe Nawandarge. And so, you know, it makes sense. You know, he's Lama Tisha saying, I found this most helpful to the degenerate age. And I know for myself personally, it was this thought training teaching that, you know, really helped me so much, because I was kind of a mess when I met the Dharma. I mean, just uncontrolled emotions and blah, you know, wrong views and depression and the whole nine yards, even though I look normal and happy, you know. I mean, because you can look normal and happy and have a mess in your mind, can't you? Yeah. And people still think you're normal and happy. Okay. But I know for myself, it was really these thought training teachings that taught me how to look at life in a constructive way, you know, and how to understand karma and how to open my mind to have some kind of tolerance and compassion for other people's suffering and have, you know, tolerance for all their foibles. And now, I can't say I've mastered any of that, but, you know, the thought training teachings are just such an incredible refuge when your mind goes bonkers, you know. So it's kind of, you know, your mind goes crazy with anger or attachment or resentment or belligerence or whatever it is. And, like, what are you going to call for 911 to help you when your mind's going crazy? You know, the thing that I've always called is the thought training teachings, because there's always a method in there for how to work with the mind. Yeah. And so then the person who's writing the colophon continues. He says, from amongst his inconceivable number of disciples in India and Tibet, Atisha bestowed this teaching to the most qualified vessel, Upasaka, which meant Drumdumpa. So Drumdumpa was a layman who was one of Lama Tisha's closest disciples. So Drumdumpa, who was prophesied by many meditational deities such as Bhagavati Tara. This teaching was given to help tame the hardened people of Tibet, a land outside the bounds of civilization. How about this teaching was given to help tame the hardened people of America, a land outside the bounds of civilization. Okay, the father conqueror and his son, meaning Lama Tisha and Drumdumpa, themselves acted as pundit and translator for the text. So they translated the text together. And then Atisha gave this teaching to Drumdumpa, who then transmitted it to Potowa, and thence in linear order to Sharapa, Chekawa, Chopupa, La Chenmo, La Drowe Gompo, Ojopa, Kempo Martin, Kempo Sherab Dorje, Buddha Ratna, Kirti Shila, Gyawa Zangpo, Nup Trulungpa Sonam Rinchen, and he to myself, Shono Gyatso Kunchokban. Then it says this text belongs to the cycle of Dhammarakshita's training the mind teachings. And then Geshe Nawandargi said in conclusion, he talked about how difficult it is to have a precious human life. You know, which isn't just any human life. It's a human life with all the conditions necessary to practice the Dharma. And that's pretty hard to get, because you have to have met the teachings and have faith in the teachings, have time to practice, have willingness to practice, having the material wherewithal to practice, having a teacher, having a supportive community. There's so many conditions necessary to have a precious human life. So, he said that it's hard to receive a precious human life, but having received it, use it to practice these teachings. And that's the best way to repay the kindness of your guru. Okay, so that's the best offering we can make to our teachers, is to really put in practice the teachings. So he said we're in cyclic existence because we haven't met qualified Mahayana gurus, and even if we meet qualified Mahayana gurus, it's going to take us three countless great eons to attain enlightenment because we haven't met the right Vajrayana guru. So we should pray for that, to meet proper, you know, fully qualified Mahayana and Vajrayana gurus. And then also we should try and become proper and qualified disciples. You might have a proper guru, but if as a disciple you're kind of a mess, and you can't benefit. Similarly, if you're a very good disciple, but your guru's a mess, you can't benefit. So you need both of them together. The worst is when both guru and disciple are messes. Okay? So Drumdampa was an excellent disciple. And so he entrusted himself to the Lamrim and the Thok training. And Bodhicitta. And as Lama Atisha advised him, Drumdampa made Bodhicitta his main practice. So if it's good enough for Atisha and Drumdampa, it's good enough for us, isn't it? You know, kind of what more magnificent teaching could we ever wish for or want than the Bodhicitta teachings, you know, the teachings that lead us to full enlightenment. So, you know, sometimes we take the Mahayana teachings so much for granted, yeah? But it's interesting. Sometimes you meet people who just find the Mahayana too difficult, or it's too big, or it's too vast, or it's too something, you know? And they would really much prefer just to liberate themselves. And you go, oh, wow, you know, what did I do right that somehow my mind is really attracted to these teachings, you know, based on the intention to become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings? How did I ever get so lucky that I really appreciate this altruistic intention, you know, enough to dedicate my life to it, even though our understanding of it is still small? You know, still that fortune to have that connection and to really appreciate these kinds of teachings. It's just incredible. You know, I mean, because we could have been born as people who were New Age people who, you know. You know, I mean, we could be sitting inside a pyramid with crystals all around us, you know, drinking special potions, having our third eye open for only 999.99, you know. But how instead did we wind up getting to hear this precious teaching from, you know, Dharma Rakshita? So, you know. Really, I mean, sometimes we put ourselves down so much. Oh, I'm so stupid. I'm so inferior. I do everything wrong. But you, when you look at just this opportunity that we have to study these teachings, it didn't come by accident. It came because we accumulated the causes, you know. So we got to give ourselves some credit for what we did in a previous life. And then having, you know, work so hard in a previous life to meet these teachings in this life, then really make use of the opportunity that we have right now to learn them well and to put them into practice as much as we can, because that will help us this lifetime. It'll put imprints in our minds so that in future lifetimes we'll meet these teachings and meet perfectly qualified teachers who will instruct us in how to practice them. You know, so if we just do our best in this lifetime, then that's really something quite considerable. So then the Tibetans always have this thing of starting at the beginning of the text. So since I received this verse from Geshe Melendage, and I think later, received it a few times. That one that really had the most impact on me, the first one. So may we all hear this text in future lives from Geshe Melendage. It's an incredible teacher. So there's the tradition of reading the very beginning verses a few times too, so that you start it again and then you leave something undone. So that means then you have to meet again to finish it. So it starts out, homage to the three jewels. This is the wheel weapon striking at the vital point of the enemy. Homage to the wrathful Yamantaka. When peacocks roam through the jungle of virulent poison, though the gardens of medicinal plants are attractive, the peacock flock will not be seduced, for they thrive on the essence of virulent poisons. Likewise, when heroes enter the jungle of cyclic existence, though the gardens of happiness and prosperity are exquisite, the assembly of heroes will not be seduced, for they thrive in the jungle of suffering. Thus those who avidly pursue happiness and prosperity are brought to suffering because of their cowardice. But the bodhisattvas who willingly embrace suffering are always joyful because of their heroism. Now here, desire is like the jungle of virulent poison. The peacock-like heroes alone can digest this. But for the crow-like cowards, it spells their death. For how can the self-centered digest such a poison? When you extend this analogy to other afflictions, like the poison to a crow, they all assail the life of liberation. Therefore, the peacock-like heroes must transform into elixir the afflictions that resemble the jungle of poison. In this way, they must enter the jungle of cyclic existence and embrace the afflictions and destroy their poison. From now on, divorce from this well-being, this helpless wanderer, this self-grasping who is the emissary of demons, which seeks its own selfish happiness and prosperity, joyfully embrace hardship for the sake of others. Good place to stop.